Today's reading comes from Matthew 28, verses 16 to 20, known as the Great Commission. Then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. Then Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always to the very end of the age." This is the word of the Lord.
Thank you. Kia ora and good morning, everybody. So as Julia said, and as Sue said before that, we are going to begin with a mystery, specifically a game. The game is very simple. In this box is three items. I'm going to come around to see three people, and you're going to give me a guess as to what you think could be in the box. You can give it a rattle, you can listen to it, you can tip it upside down, whatever you like. I'm going to begin with Prue, because I've primed her for this. So if we could just have a guess of what you think. Oh no, I couldn't tell you what you're supposed to do. That's no fun. A timbrel? There we go. We have one guess for a timbrel. Do I have any other takers? Would anyone else like a guess? Joseph would like a guess. Here we go. A rubber duck wrapped in newspaper. You can never guess these things. A timbrel and a rubber duck. I need one more person to play. There we go. We've got Thomas on the sound desk. Have a listen, sir.
A car.
A car. Well, we'll have to open it up and see, won't we? What do we have in my lovely wrapped package? Well, what we have here is a crunchy bar, a peanut slab, and a Kinder Surprise. So, you get to choose one of the... You did guess right. You see, the tradition is the answer is either Jesus or chocolate. But this morning... Jesus is the chocolate, and he is the Holy Spirit, and he is the Father, because this morning we're doing the Trinity. So we selected three things that are the same, yet slightly different. So the thing is, what I'd like to demonstrate, or what I hope was demonstrated there, we humans, we typically enjoy mystery. We typically enjoy anything that has a bit of intrigue. When we see an unopened box or a present, we're immediately curious. When a package turns up at your doorstep, what's the first thing that you do? Open it? Is it for me? Yes. And maybe it might just be me, but I will check the package at my doorstep even when I know it's not for me. I'm married to a mildly famous New Zealand book docker who gets sent books fairly regularly. So we end up with lots of packages, and I still check the boxes to see whether or not the label might be for me, whether or not it's a mystery I get to solve. And I think that experience is reasonably universal for us humans. We enjoy mystery, we enjoy intrigue and excitement. Yet when it comes to the mystery of the Trinity, all of a sudden our posture seems to change. We sort of, rather than being excited or curious, we tend to shrink. We withdraw. If I was to play a word association game and say, what's the first thing you think of when I say the word Trinity, how many of us would say something positive? It's Clover. How many of us, well, unless it's that, might say something closer to complicated or confusing? So this morning, what I'd like to do is invite us into a different posture. I'd like to invite us to approach the profound mystery of the Trinity from a place of excitement and curiosity. And in order to show that, I'd like to present three headings, because it needs to be the rule of three this morning, for us to ponder. So we have, what is the Trinity? Why does it matter? and how do we engage with it? The what, the why, and the how. The theologian Don Carson explains that when we use the term Trinity, what we're really referring to is a one-word summary of a whole list of truths that all come together to form the one doctrine. What do I mean? Well, in the Old Testament, the people of God understood God to be an individual named Yahweh. But even that understanding was shrouded in some mystery. At the creation of the world, we have God's Ruah, his spirit, his breath, resting over the surface of the unformed world. And in the Aramaic translation, they describe it like a dove fluttering over the waters. Seemingly the same God, but a bit of a strange personification to attach to him. Then in Genesis 18, we have the strange interaction between Abraham and the Lord, who appears with two angels. And he comes in the form of a man. And if that wasn't strange enough, in the next chapter over, we see the Lord on earth calling upon the Lord in heaven. Two lords. And then we have the visions of Daniel, the prophetic imagery of all the Old Testament, and that speaks of a coming king, one who exists in the presence of God and is worshipped by all people, all languages around the world. We fast forward 2,000 years, and we have this guy called Jesus. Now, Jesus claims to be that foretold king, and despite his ministry of radical love, or rather because of it, he's sentenced to death. And his cross is set between two men, not angels this time, but two criminals. Yet, as we know, Jesus doesn't stay dead. And finally, we arrive at our passage for this morning, where Jesus commissions us to go out and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. Who's the Holy Spirit, you ask? Well, we sort of had a panel of discussion about that, and I think many of us found out, had a renewed experience last week, and certainly they found out at Pentecost all those years ago. And that's a lot to take in. You can imagine what it must have been like for those first century Jews, and indeed for the early Christians. Both groups were routinely mocked for being monotheists, so like believing in one God, because all the cultures around them were polytheists. They believed in whole pantheons of gods. This idea of believing in just one God was so strange that you'd end up with Romans calling Christians atheists. So you can imagine the mental overload, the challenge of our spiritual ancestors trying to reconcile there being one God with three distinct persons. Not three gods. Not two gods or one Herculean hero who ascends to godhood, nor God shape-shifting into three forms, but one God who exists in a divine community, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, coexisting in perfect love, differential love, each preferring the other, glorifying the other since before the world began. You can see why it took over 300 years to arrive at this doctrine. It is, and was, and is, a profound mystery. The Trinity is so mysterious, in fact, I think it serves as one of the most convincing proofs that Christianity is the real deal. Because if you were manufacturing a religion, you would never come up with the Trinity. It contradicted everyone's understanding at the time. It overloads our mental circuits. The only reason anyone would arrive at this conclusion is because they are honestly wrestling with the lived experience of God. They are trying to make sense of a mystery. And in the same way, I think if we take the time to be curious, to conduct our own investigation, we may just find that within this profound, complex mystery lies a profound hope, the likes of which cannot be found anywhere else. And this leads me nicely to the second point, the why. Why does the Trinity even matter? As usual, I find myself leaning on the late Dr. Keller pretty heavily this morning, specifically one of his sermons from 2006, where he summarizes the why question loosely like this. If God were an individual, unipersonal, floating out there on his own, then we couldn't say that before creation there was love. We can't say before all things there was love because love requires more than one person to exist. Love is about preferring another, prioritizing another. If there's no other in existence, then there's no relationships. And if there's no relationships, there's no love. Which would mean that the essence of God, that thing that called the universe into being, it wasn't love, but power. If God is unipersonal, it's not love that called the universe into being, but power. Awesome, individual power. That would be cosmic bedrock. The purpose of life, therefore, the most important thing would be to empower the self, to strive for individual greatness, because those things would reflect God. They would reflect creation. Only if God exists in relationship, in loving community, can love be the cause of creation. I'll say that again. Only because of the Trinity can we confidently say that the essence of God isn't individual power or greatness, but love and relationship. In fact, that would mean that relationships of love are what life is really about. What do all the famous people say, all our celebrities who make it to the pinnacle of human acclaim? Think of Jim Carrey, the actor. "I think everybody should get rich and famous and do everything they've ever dreamed of so they can see it's not the answer." The Trinity teaches us that love relationships are the most important thing in the universe. And if you live for anything else at all, as Keller puts it, your life will be dashed upon the rocks of reality. Because love is ultimate reality. Not power, not greatness, not any kind of self-centered gain. Love is the bedrock of creation. And this takes us to point three. How do we engage with the Trinity? What do we actually do with this information? Well, I'd like to leave us with two things, two takeaways to contemplate this morning. First, we need to understand that we're never going to come to grips with the Trinity as individuals. To understand a communal God, we need to be in community. We need to prioritize relationships. We need to put each other's interests ahead of our own. You remember last month, we talked about the church not being something we attend, but something we become. Relationships of love is how we get there. Like many of us, I've been in communities where relationships weren't at the forefront, communities that weren't really interested in me as a person. All that really mattered was me turning up, my service, kind of like church is a second job, but you get paid in crowns in heaven, whatever those do. The challenge for us here at All Saints, and at all of our churches in our parish, is to be a community that reflects the relational love of the Trinity. Whether that means joining a small group, starting a sports team, a club, a prayer triplet, or coming along to the beer and Bible group that the men's are going to this evening, the man's. Whatever you're into, whatever works. It really doesn't matter. We just need to find regular spaces where we can connect with one another, where we can practice love relationships and make it a priority. Make relationships a priority. We cannot become church through attendance alone. We become church through genuine, loving relationships. All right, point two, final point of application. Just as the Trinity glorifies each other, that kind of deferential love, we need to glorify God. What do I mean? Well, in one of the most incredible passages you'll find anywhere in the Bible, I think, it's John 17, verses 21 to 24. Jesus has this to say. "Father, just as you are in me and I am in you, may they also be in us. I have given them the glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one. I in them and you in me, so that they may be brought to complete unity. Father, I want those you have given me to be with me where I am, and to see my glory, to the glory you have given me, because you loved me before the creation of the world." Guess what happens to Jesus immediately after this prayer? He's arrested, he's condemned, and he's executed. Betrayed by the very beings he came to save. On the cross, Jesus Christ invites us into the love relationship of the Trinity. Think about that. This is the same loving relationship that Jesus has enjoyed for all eternity. He offers that to us. Verse 21 and 22, may they also be in us. May they be one as we are one. I in them and you in me. Imagine for a moment you have the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit all orbiting each other, all glorifying each other, deferring to each other in perfect loving harmony. So you have this perfect example of a love relationship. And now imagine the Son, Jesus, deferring to you, glorifying you. Literally, Jesus says, I have given them the glory you gave me. Jesus defers to you in your needs. He glorifies you and me to the extent that he would come to earth and die in our place. And for what? To gain glory, to have relationships with us? He already had that. He was part of the Trinity. He had ultimate reality. The Trinity is the expression, the ultimate expression of love and relationship. And on the cross, Jesus was excluded from that love. All Jesus had ever known was perfect relationship, and he gave it all up for a relationship with you. For a love relationship with you and with me. If ever there were someone worthy of glory, worthy of our affection, our worship, is it not Jesus? If there's one thing to take away from this morning, I hope that we can see the Trinity isn't frightening. It's complex, but it's beautiful. It's a beautiful mystery. It's actually a doctrine of hope. Without it, we don't have love, we just have power. Because of it, because of what Jesus has done, we are invited into that love. We are one, just as God is one. The ultimate loving relationship, ultimate reality. May we prioritize relationships of love, and may we glorify God just as Christ glorifies us. We're going to have a moment to do that now, if you'd like to stand.